I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Tuesday, this hour, we're going to be talking about the film Selma, which recently opened in theaters all over the country. I had a chance to see it on Sunday and hope that many of you did as well. Our guest this hour has been with us before talking about his book. He knows this period of U.S. history very, very well. He's the author of Bending Toward Justice, The Voting Rights Act, and the Transformation of American Democracy. Gary May is professor of history at the University of Delaware, and he wrote a piece that appeared in Daily Beast on this film, and he says that really it's a flawed history of Selma. Generations of young students now learn American history through film, and his students will now believe that what they saw in the film about Selma was actually what happened. I found that to be the case when I was watching the film as well. Some of the people in the audience afterwards said, we need to bring our students to see this film because they need to know their history. So we'll learn more about what actually happened in Selma, what the relationship between Martin Luther King and President Lyndon Johnson was. Was he really reluctant to bring the Voting Rights Act before Congress? What's the true history there? And what about the unsung heroes of Selma? Did the film place enough emphasis on those people? Was it a movement that was already there and Martin Luther King just solidified the movement? Were they given enough attention in the film to be shown as true heroes? We have a lot to talk about this hour. We have, as you know, the film is directed by an African-American woman, Ava DuVernay, and we have invited her to be on the show as well. So KP is working on that, and we hope to have her on soon. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Professor Gary May, thank you very much for being with us.
Always a pleasure being with you, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Well, let's start with the portrayal of Lyndon Baines Johnson, because that's what a lot of the historians have been criticizing. And I must say that he was booed during the performance that I saw of Selma on Sunday by members of the audience. Is this a terribly...
That's very interesting, because when I saw the film in an early screening on November 14th, the audience, which consisted, I think, of mostly internet journalists and bloggers, they hissed Johnson when he was there. So that kind of confirms my fear that whether intentional or not, Lyndon Johnson comes off as, if not quite the villain of the movie, certainly a negative force. It was a difficult relationship. It was a strained relationship. Johnson, you know, had an ego the size of Texas, so there was very little room on the national or even the world stage for anyone but him. So he actually preferred working with older civil rights leaders like the NAACP's Roy Wilkins, people who he could control.
And
go ahead.
I was reading carefully your part of the book that deals with his thoughts about the Voting Rights Act and his conversation with Nicholas Katzenbach and his consideration of a voting rights bill as early as July of 1964. The backstory is what we don't see in the film, that the Civil Rights Bill had been enacted, and evidently he thought you can only do so much at one time.
That's right. The in July of 1964, he signed into law the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and it was a very controversial act in that it desegregated hotels and motels and theaters in the South, and he did not feel that the Congress or the country was quite ready yet for another major civil rights bill. Indeed, you're quite right that he was an enthusiastic supporter of voting rights, wanted to do a voting rights bill. indeed ordered his attorney general in December of 64 to actually start drafting a voting rights bill. But, you know, there were, and I don't think Ava DuVernay quite conveyed this to the audience, the obstacles that Johnson faced. Like any president, they can't simply wave a magic wand and create legislation that they want. Mm-hmm. You know, there are for him there's the Southern opposition in the Congress, and Southerners in those days controlled all the major committees of the House and Senate. And so if he alienated them, as he already had by signing the 64 Act, his legislative program could be doomed. He had to craft a bill that could pass constitutional muster. It would eventually go to the Supreme Court. It had to be a bill that they would find constitutional. Voting, you know, had historically and constitutionally been a matter for states to decide. So to create a bill that put the federal government into that state activity was bound to be controversial. So there were all of these things, you know, going through Johnson's mind, as well as, you know, the other parts of his legislative program. We don't get that sense, you know, from the film. He just seems to be not only reluctant, but just obstructionist.
Right. And I think that there are problems with that. And maybe Hollywood people feel that they just need to have some kind of villain. But when you do have, as you mentioned in the piece that you wrote in The Daily Beast, when you have young people getting their history from movies, and when there were people in the audience when I saw the film saying young people need to see this so they know their history, then you think, well, I really want them to know the history as well. And the history is much more nuanced than this. And if you're going to make a president a villain in a piece, then you're running the risk of, you know, creating a history that isn't true, and people shouldn't believe that was the truth.
It's very troubling. You know, if they needed a villain, they could make it, you know, the political system that, you know, was designed to block change. You know, different parts of the government and the legislative, the executive, the judicial, and, you know, it's a system that really is designed more to prevent change than to facilitate it. Now, that would have been too vague, I suppose, for an audience. Better, you know,
right,
that you have one specific symbolic villain, and in this case, one reason or another, it became LBJ.
Mm-hmm. You know who I liked best in the whole film, and he wasn't a major character, but I thought that she really captured, in his performance, captured the true heroism of the people in Selma, and that was Jimmie Lee Jackson's grandfather, Keijer Lee. Mm. I thought he was marvelous in this film. Did you think so?
Was.
Wasn't he great?
Yeah, I did. The real Keijer Lee was actually, I think, 87, and that the gentleman who portrayed him, I think, was somewhat younger.
Mm-hmm.
Than that. It was a very good performance, and in many ways true to the real person as well. I mean, obviously he was just, you know, very devastated by the death of his grandson, and again, in something that she did not show, when one of King's aides, Jim Bevel, met with him, he said, well, should we continue this effort? And Mr. Lee said, yes, by all means, you know, yeah, you need to carry on. It would have been nice to see that, but to be fair, you can't put everything in a movie. But, you know, one of the questions that emerges here is that when a filmmaker deals with actual events or real personalities, should they be held to a higher standard, you know,
right,
than if they were simply filming a fictional story? You know, some people think that filmmakers should have room to cut things, to move chronology around, which Ava does quite a bit in the movie. I know it's something that a historian couldn't get away with.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and it's a legitimate question. We'll ask the audience that and see what they have to say. Our number is 800-486-8655. You do write in that piece that the good news is that her greatest achievement, overcoming the resistance, prevented Hollywood from making films about the civil rights movement. So here it is. She has been able to make this film. Why hasn't Hollywood made films about the civil rights movement?
Well, first, historical films are usually very expensive to make, and Hollywood often shies away from those kinds of films, expensive films, unless it's, a brand film, a superhero film, which has already proved to be, terrific at the box office. For a long time, it was thought that films about African Americans would appeal only to a very small audience and wouldn't play well abroad. The foreign markets have almost become as important as domestic markets to studios. There's a problem with the King family. You have to make a film that is respectful to Dr. King and one that will be accepted by the King family. One of Ava's obstacles in making the film was that she had to paraphrase Dr. King's speeches because the family owned the rights. Well, actually, the family sold the rights to his speeches to Steven Spielberg.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Doing his own King film.
Oh.
So, that's why some of the speeches, well, I think they're good, and delivered very well by David Oyelowo. Again, they're not the great King speeches that that we remember. So those reasons, I think, have prevented making a good King civil rights film, and that is, I think, Ava's greatest triumph. That at last, at long last, we have a film about King and the civil rights movement where African Americans are the heroes of their own history. In the past, we've had too many films like Mississippi Burning and The Ghosts of Mississippi, and even films like The Help and The Butler, where, white people are the key characters, always there to rescue helpless black people, and this, I think, is Ava's greatest triumph, and I would imagine Oprah Winfrey was absolutely indispensable in bringing this off.
I had no idea that the rights to the speeches were sold to Steven Spielberg. Somehow that just really rubs me the wrong way. Dr. King's speech is the master of all speech makers, the importance of the words to sell the rights to all of those words.
I know.
It's not good.
No doubt it would have disappointed Dr. King,
yes,
who lived almost a pauper's life. But we should also point out that when he died, he didn't even leave a will. And it was Harry Belafonte who paid for the education of his children. So, those children paid a price for Dr. King's greatness.
Yes. What about the portrayal, and you've written about this, that we do have a more human King in his portrayal in Selma?
I think we do, and it's wonderful to see him as a father and as a conflicted husband, and as a leader, a brilliant strategist who is every bit the equal to Lyndon Johnson. Now, what do we have? We have, as Ava has put it, a statue and a speech, and it's too bad because he was a very fascinating character besides being a great man. So, and I know that was one of her goals, to sort of de-iconize him, And I think she succeeded very well at that.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting because the scenes with LBJ meeting George Wallace were, as I was reading your book again last night, those were almost word for word, very historically accurate. You quote them in your book, and I remember hearing those in the film.
Yes. However, there was one point that she did not present, and that is, again, part of LBJ's strategy to overpower George Wallace. He intentionally put him, seated him on couch where he would sink into it, allowing LBJ to sort of tower over him even as he was sitting in a chair. The part that I wrote about really is drawn from a couple of oral histories, one by Richard Goodwin, who wrote Johnson's famous We Shall Overcome speech, and who was there and tells that story, and it's an absolutely wonderful moment. Again, for me, not quite fully brought off. I was fortunate enough to be accompanied by my daughter when I saw the film. And she said to me, this must be for you kind of like watching home movies. So it was. I was almost, aware of what was going on in every scene, what was right and what was not
quite right. I'm sure you were. I'm sure you were. We welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Gary May. He's the author of Bending Toward Justice, The Voting Rights Act, and the Transformation of American Democracy. He teaches history at the University of Delaware. He's a professor there, and he wrote a piece that he sent to us it's in the Daily Beast, that looked at the film Selma. And, of course, a lot has been written about, and he writes about the fact that it's a lot of people are seeing this film as history, and there are significant problems with the history in the film. Does that make a difference to you? Does it make a difference that the president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, was portrayed in such a negative light? Is there a way to do history to make it Hollywood presentable and still be more accurate? We certainly welcome your phone calls, and we have a ton of them. Great. All right, we'll be with you in a moment. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. If you can't get through, please leave your thoughts on our Facebook page, too, because they're always great to read, both on the show and when the show is over. To you momentarily, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for our guest, Professor Gary May, author of Bending Toward Justice, The Voting Rights Act, and the Transformation of American Democracy. And Randy in Peoria is our first caller. Hi, Randy.
Hi. I regret or would caution the idea that things are not historically accurate, because I live in an area of Illinois where there's many Democrats who they've worked for unions and stuff over the years. And what they think about Johnson is this. He did not deal with J. Edgar Hoover. And behind any criticism of Johnson always lies that reality. Instead of dealing with Hoover, he actually monumentized him. I think any politician today that sees Johnson positively and doesn't understand the terrible legacy Hoover has left people with. And yet there's a building today and everything in Washington, largely because Johnson said, oh, the nation is grateful to you, Edgar, and so on. And all the time, Hoover was doing terrible, terrible things.
All right, let's get a response. Gary.
Well, Randy's partly right. President Roosevelt, Truman, Kennedy, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson were in many ways prisoners of J. Edgar Hoover. He became really a separate branch of government. But one of the problems with the film is it's very strong implication that Johnson conspired with Hoover to destroy Martin Luther King's marriage and his career. You see Hoover and Johnson meeting in the film, and the next thing you see is Coretta King listening to that tape. As my friend, the historian Diane McWhorter, puts it, it's the sex tape, stupid. For her, that's the most serious problem in the film. So Johnson really joins a long line of American presidents who had problems dealing with J. Edgar Hoover, and as did Richard Nixon, who was probably closer to Hoover than any of the others. That's my view of
you write that LBJ knew the contents of King's FBI file and feared a close relationship with him would tarnish the presidency. What did he know about the FBI file?
Well, he knew everything that was in it. Johnson, one of his less flattering qualities was that he loved gossip, and so he would read everything that Hoover sent him. There were two things that were troubling and potentially threatening to Johnson if he aligned himself closely closely with King. One was the fact that King had an advisor, a lawyer named Stanley Levinson, who had had connections with the American Communist Party back in the 1950s. But at the time that he became a close advisor to King, he had left the party and really had no further relationship with it. That was, of course, not good enough for J. Edgar Hoover. You know, once a friend of the communists, always a friend of the communists.
Mm-hmm.
And so he felt that the movement was communist based. Johnson did not go that far, but he understood still the fear of communism in America, and he'd seen how earlier administrations, which had been considered soft on communism, were destroyed. The second problem, of course, was King's extramarital affairs, which the FBI was keeping track of through extraordinary surveillance. They bugged his home phones, his office phones, followed him wherever he went. Johnson was concerned that if that became public knowledge, that would hurt King very badly, and in turn him as a partner. So in some ways, he tried to keep a sort of personal distance from King. In fact, when King was assassinated in 1968, President Johnson did not attend his funeral. It was, as I said, it was a delicate relationship that these two men had.
Let's go. Randy, thanks for your call. Richard in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. How are you, Richard?
I'm still kicking.
Good.
I think the gist of the movie is that the work of this nation that was imagined by people long ago, well, not all that long ago, but
50 years ago,
not yet done. It probably will never be done. But we can be grateful that we have our ancestors' achievements. They've left us something to work with. And King's will is not, he left a will. He left a will of love, of decency, of fairness, of hope. And his extramarital affairs just showed he was human. He's not perfect. So all of us can, none of us are perfect, so we can all pitch in. We can find a way to make things better. The way some of us imagine, and all of us really imagine it could be.
Thank you so much for your call, Richard. Gary?
That is very well put. We are always a work in progress as a democracy. I ended that piece in the Daily Beast by saying that this is King's legacy, that he remained committed to nonviolence, and he always believed, as he put it in the speech at the end of the Voting Rights March, that the arc of the universe is wide, but it bends toward justice. And I think that's part of the genius of America, and it's a very rich legacy that King has left us. Mm.
The screening that I saw, a lot of people in the audience were with Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope, and people in the audience were very much centered on what needs to be done now. They were looking at a police killing in Milwaukee, the Dontre Hamilton case. There was talk about the Supreme Court and restrictions that have been placed on voting once again, that there is much work that remains to be done. And it is true, after seeing that, you do look at certainly voting restrictions and how in the world it could possibly be more difficult for people to vote after what people went through. And certainly Oprah Winfrey does a fine job of letting us know, just by her part in the film, what people went through.
Yeah, that's a wonderful scene, and pretty much accurate. It would have been nice to know a little bit more, again, of the backstory, that Annie Lee Cooper had been able to vote in a number of other states where she lived before returning to Selma to care for her aged mother, and suddenly finding that she could not vote. And something else that we didn't learn was that by trying to register to vote, she lost her job.
Right.
She was fired. I always want more.
Right. I guess we just need another film. Tell me about, because this wasn't really covered in the film, when the second march after Bloody Sunday is taking place, and people have come from all over the country, a lot of white people have come to Selma, and King is leading a march over the bridge once again, and he stops and kneels before he gets to the other side, even before the halfway point. And then everybody's mad at him because, you know, he should have gone farther than he did. I had not remembered, or if I ever knew, how that decision was made, and you remind us of that.
Well, what had happened was a deal had been arranged. King was not 100% certain that it would come off, but an official from the Johnson administration, Leroy Collins, a former governor of Florida, who was head of the new Community Relations Service, went to meet with King, and he said, look, if I could get Wallace and Sheriff Clark's people to hold off, to not assault the marchers, would you just go to the point where the Bloody Sunday assault had occurred, kneel, pray, and then turn around and go back to your church? Would that be acceptable to you? Now, King did not want to march all the way because, one, they hadn't really prepared for a five-day march. But more importantly, Judge Frank Johnson had prohibited the march. He wanted to hold a hearing to decide whether it was both constitutional and appropriate for another march to be held. And King had never violated a federal court order. So Governor Collins gave him this deal. And King said, well, you know, if you can get Wallace and Clark to go with it, you know, that's what we'll do. So when he got there, it appeared that Wallace at least kept his bargain this time, and the troops pulled back, and he turned and walked away. For me, that was the most garbled part of the film, because you don't fully understand why he's turned around, and you see people quite correctly complaining about that, and he admits that he doesn't know why that happened. Well, it happened because of this deal, and it was one of the sort of more controversial moments in King's leadership. I mean, again, if Ava wanted to show the complexity of what King faced, it might have been good to show that that a deal had been made. But without it, I'm not sure what kind of an impression it leaves with the audience.
Mm-hmm. It was murky, I think. You're right. Let's go to Jim next. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. I have a more general comment. Historical films are my favorite, but unfortunately, I'm afraid most Americans get their history now from films. And so I think it's important for the filmmaker to make, even if the story is somewhat truncated, I think it's important to be as accurate as possible. Just because most people get their history these days from film.
Well, it's, Jim, it's certainly something I share. For me, what's so fascinating about this story, and I write about these events in Bending Toward Justice, these events are so dramatic and ultimately inspiring that really you wouldn't have to change a thing. You wouldn't have to embellish anything. You could film it almost as is, and it would be accurate and exciting. I mean, so often there's a division between art and reality. The history has to be monkeyed with to make it more exciting. But these events are so intrinsically interesting that you could have filmed it as is, and you would have been both artful and accurate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your call, Jim. And we have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And our guest this hour is discussing the historical problems with Selma. He is a historian who knows this period of history like the back of his hand, Gary May. The book is Bending Toward Justice, his latest book, The Voting Rights Act and the Transformation of American Democracy. He's a professor of history at the University of Delaware, and we're welcoming phone calls, particularly interested in hearing from those of you who may have seen the film. Just to get back to Johnson for a moment, and I believe that this is in your book as well, which is pretty an incredible statement. This is shortly after signing on July 2nd, 1964, the Civil Rights Bill, LBJ telling his Attorney General, Nicholas Katzenbach, "I want you to write me the toughest blank-blank Voting Rights Act you can devise." And Katzenbach is saying, "I could have shot him. I was so tired of beating down and the halls of Congress on the 64 Act. The president had no intention of resting on his laurels after the Civil Rights Act. Johnson was hell-bent to get every piece of civil rights legislation he could get."
Well, that was certainly true. And I guess we can thank Barry Goldwater for much of Johnson's success. He proved such a wonderful candidate to run against. And of course, Johnson had the huge electoral victory in 1964. And what it did was to bring into the House and Senate the most liberal majorities since the New Deal. And so, I mean, part of Johnson's genius was also the fact that he had the votes.
Right.
And was able to to work with people. What I also found very interesting, and we don't see this in the film because, of course, it doesn't go beyond the march from Selma to Montgomery, is how the Republican Party is a partner with Lyndon Johnson in creating the Voting Rights Act. I mean, the bill is almost literally written in the office of the Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen. And of course, today's Republican Party has chosen to be on the side of the segregationist South, and opposed to making voting as simple a process as possible. And it was those conservatives on the Supreme Court that gutted the Voting Rights Act in June 2013.
More phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655. How historically accurate or not the film Selma is. And does it make a difference this hour of the show? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Jerry in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jerry.
Good afternoon, Captain. Hi. You're a guest. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. You know, about the film, you know, I first want to make this disclaimer, I had not seen it. However, the film is not a documentary film. It's not about Lyndon Johnson. I think the author, according to what I read and heard, was her criteria is the truth. So that to incorporate story about Lyndon Johnson and George Wallace, Edgar Hoover, would require about four films, you know. But she tried to deal with, in my opinion, civil rights, A, B, Martin Luther King. I think that, you know, Americans want the villain, as you said earlier. They need that. Plus, this is history. It's not about villains. You know, it's about the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're villains involved, well, so be it. But history is the key. It was, I think, her objective. I lived part of that life. You know, I lived in New York. I remember traveling down south to see my grandfather in Alabama. At that time, I knew nothing about segregation, and I didn't understand it. I was young. My mother and father, who were both educated, college educated, tried to protect us, the four of us, siblings, I think at that time, in terms of not discussing it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way they protected us. However, I remember coming back to New York, to Long Island, and when I was 11 years old, we'd have to recite the Pledge of Allegiance every morning. That was required. Suddenly, the words didn't mean anything to me. It was a lie to me. Based on my experience in traveling down south.
Mm-hmm. Gary.
Yes. It was a very difficult period in our history.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, I mean, you're quite right. This is a film about the civil rights movement. Not about Lyndon Johnson, although obviously you can't make a film about Selma and the voting rights movement without having Lyndon Johnson in it. But one of the things that, Kathleen, you mentioned at the outset that we haven't talked about is something else that bothered me about the film. Ava has said repeatedly that the title of this film is not King, it's Selma. And the film is a love letter to the Selma voting rights movement. Well, for me, I didn't see much of that movement in the film, with the exception of Annie Lee Cooper, played by Oprah Winfrey, and Amelia Boynton, who was for decades the leader of the voting rights movement with her husband in Selma, who I write about in the first two chapters. Where, for example, are Selma's teachers, who were afraid to participate in the voting rights movement because their jobs were dependent upon white school boards? And then they were shamed into it by their students. Their students said, how can you teach us government when you can't vote? And so on January 22nd, Selma's teachers marched on the registrar's office, dressed as if they were going to church, waving toothbrushes to indicate that they were willing to spend the night in jail or longer to register to vote. Where are Selma's students? On February 10th, a group of them marched on the registrar's office. Sheriff Clark brutalized them, force-marched them out of town, beat them with billy clubs, and shocked them with electric cattle prods. There are two scenes I
would have loved to have seen in the film. If they had been in the film, I probably would never have written that article.
Oh, that's interesting.
Film.
And if somebody would just make a film about that, it could be a spectacular and very important film, Gary.
Yes.
Wouldn't
yes.
it?
Every bit as dramatic and
yes.
inspiring as any historical film.
Thanks, Jerry, for your call. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest would comment on the fact that Dr. King and President Johnson were going to be at loggerheads about Vietnam, about going to war. Dr. King was against war, and Johnson was for war. Another thing, Dr. King was trying to share the wealth so that none would be too rich and none too poor. And, of course, Johnson was on the side of making money, especially off the wall.
Well, there are repeated references to Vietnam and King saying that Johnson has enough money for the war, but not to improve the lives of African Americans or for this particular issue. Were those true? Did he make references?
Yes, yes, they were true. But it really isn't until 1966, 1967 that Dr. King finally felt that given who he was, that he had to speak out against the war. And John is quite right that it really broke the relationship between the two men. Johnson was absolutely furious. And not only Johnson, the New York Times editorialized against King speaking out, you know, against America at a time of war, that kind of thing. Mm. And John's also correct that as King reached the final years of his life, he was becoming much more critical about American society and about inequality. And we should remember that his last great campaign was a poor people's march.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he did not live to carry it through. And again, I wrote about this in Betting Toward Justice, that he was having a great deal of difficulty organizing that campaign. People were just not responding. And again, Johnson was very unhappy about the thought of thousands of poor people coming to Washington and camping out until he did something about it. So as 67 became 68, King and Johnson grew more and more apart.
And Johnson and the American people grew more and more apart as well.
Yes.
John, thanks very much for the call. Cindy in Appleton, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, I would just like to say I think that movies are basically Hollywood-type entertainment, and documentaries are based on the actual and true facts, at least as close as they can get. So I think it's kind of a sad commentary if we're thinking our society is learning its history from Hollywood movies.
Well, I think part of the problem with this, and it's my own viewpoint, Gary, is that this film tried to do both, so that it was trying to be historically accurate and giving you a more human portrait of King. Some of the parts of the film where he was dealing with his advisors in opposition with young people's groups and seemed to try to be historically accurate, and then there would be other chunks that were just wildly historically inaccurate. So I think the film was trying to do both, which you can't do.
Yes. Well, someone should ask her, and if she comes, I hope she comes on your show. So
yeah, I do too. Yes.
Get some answers to these questions. Was it the fact that she inherited a screenplay that apparently was much different from what the final shooting script became? The script that Paul Webb wrote focused primarily, as I understand it, on the Johnson-King relationship. And Ava changed that. In fact, she made it one of the requirements of her accepting the job as director after people after directors would come and go on this project, which had been around for a long time, that she be able to shift the focus more toward the movement and King personally. And at least she was able to accomplish that much as well. I mean, it's interesting that, to give you a sense of what the film apparently started out as, Lee Daniels was one of the directors who had actually signed on to direct Selma in 2010. And he began to cast the film, incidentally. Lyndon Johnson was going to be played by...
Liam Neeson.
Yes, right, mm-hmm. Liam Neeson. And George Wallace was going to be played by Robert De Niro. And there were some very other... David Oyelowo was also going to be King in this version, but Daniels made a statement to a reporter. He said, "This is Lyndon Johnson's story. It's the story of a man who was basically a racist, who was able, thanks to Dr. King, to evolve into someone who wanted to be on the right side of history." So that seems to be the film that Ava inherited, and she had to, and she had little time to do it too, you know, to rework that script and to try to bring some balance to it. So that may be the problem, you know, the nature of that script that she inherited.
Thanks, Cindy, very much for your call. We have time. Our lines have been filled. To take another call if you want to get through, that would be okay. 800-486-8655 is the number. Of course, your book would be number one on the list, but where else do you suggest we go, Gary, to get, and maybe even in film or documentary of some kind, accurate portrayal of the Voting Rights Act?
Well, the classic documentary is, of course, Eyes on the Prize.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, it had been unavailable because there was some problem. The creator passed away, and there were arguments over who owned the rights. But that series is now back and available on DVD. It's a wonderful series. Again, every bit as dramatic as... A Hollywood film, and of course there's some great books. There's a book called King by historian Harvard Sitkoff, which is a short biography of King, wonderfully written, and very much worth reading. A similar book, Martin Luther King by Marshall Frady. Also wonderful. And, of course, there's the classic three-volume work by Taylor
right.
Branch,
mm-hmm.
Which is also wonderful, but very long and
very long.
Quite daunting, I think. But a good place to start would be Bending Toward Justice.
I thought you might say that, Gary, and deservedly so. Thank you very much for being with us and for writing the Daily Beast article. Have you been in direct contact with the director of the film?
Well, since writing the Daily Beast piece, I did receive an email from her. And I'm really not at liberty to quote from it specifically, but she was not happy with the piece, obviously, and a little surprised that I had written it, because we had had some contact over the previous year, and she thought I was, you know, going to be a supporter of the film. I thought I was too, because I saw her casting all of these people from the Selma movement, Amelia Boynton, Annie Lee Cooper, and I thought, okay, they're gonna get their justice. But, you know, they were there, but we don't know enough about what they actually did.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us, Gary.
Thanks again for having me.
Gary May, his book is Bending Toward Justice, the Voting Rights Act, and the Transformation of American Democracy. He's professor of history at the University of Delaware. If you've seen the film and would like to leave your review for us on our Facebook page, I'd really be interested in hearing what you think about it. And that Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Tomorrow during this time period, after the horrible attacks in Paris last week, we'll be talking about the European struggle with radical Islam, about the anti-immigrant feeling not only in Germany. It was most evident yesterday, so we'll be looking at this and also the conference that the U.S. is sponsoring February 18, I believe it is, on how to counter this kind of radicalism and terrorism. So that's coming up tomorrow. Thank you very much for listening today. And remember, the State of the State address is tonight. We will be carrying it at 7 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.